Hello, everyone. Welcome to This Must Be the Place, the Building Science Podcast. I'm your host, Shauna Henderson. Each episode is a deep conversation with a carefully chosen peer about not just houses, but place. Yeah, of course we talk about houses and retrofits, but we also want to change the industry for the better, forever. Energy poverty, community engagement, industry disruption, societal responsibility, and climate change. It's all here and so much more. Hi, we're back with This Must Be the Place. I'm your Building Science podcast host, Shauna Henderson. My guest today is architect Donna Sink, who is currently based in Indianapolis, Indiana. She's worked on urban design at cultural institutions and art exhibition design projects for the last 25 years and has lived in Philadelphia, Detroit, Portland, and Phoenix. So welcome, Donna. It's so nice to meet you in person. We have, over the last few years, been on Twitter a lot together saying, hey, yeah, that's kind of cool. I like how you're thinking. So here we are. Welcome.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here. And it's funny, I did a podcast myself many years ago, it seems now, with Arconnect. And as Twitter grew and everyone started getting to know each other, I feel like we have a really small community of architects on Twitter and in other social media realms. And I love it. I love getting to know more architects through all these different sources. So it's lovely to feel like we are sort of colleagues, even though we have never really met each other. I just really enjoy the collegiality of all the social media with our architecture friends.
And Energy Twitter is also where a lot of my social media time is spent. And that's really what started me thinking more about this podcast and the format for it is how do I get good conversations happening with all of these really incredibly interesting people who are doing incredible work and also have really like the thought process behind it is really important and wide-ranging. And those are the things that are coming out in the podcast as I'm, trying to interview as many different people in as many different realms as possible. So
And we do have, there is so much overlap with architecture Twitter, with energy as it relates to architecture Twitter, with pedestrianism and transit and all of those things as they relate to architecture. There really is a lot of overlap amongst all of us talking about the built environment. I mean, that's kind of the umbrella, I guess, is.
And let's not forget that people are the reason why we have a built environment. So
yes.
We talk about people too, right? Which is what we've talked about quite a bit. Accessibility, walkability, non-car centric, bonus points for that one, right?
And just places where humans can connect in the physical realm as well as the virtual one. Because it's still nice, especially coming out of the pandemic, maybe finally, to get together with people in the physical realm. And so having great spaces and places that we can get to each other and share, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know that you, with the list of cities that I rattled off earlier, you moved around a lot. And was that in terms of working in the architectural field, or did you have a life before architecture?
I have not had a life before architecture. I knew I wanted to be an architect when I was a teenager. But I will say that going back to my personal sort of history, my parents on both sides have been in the United States since pre-Revolutionary War and lived, their family heritages go back in the same small town in North Carolina. And so I'm a many, many, I don't know, ninth or 10th or something generation American. And no one ever left. And then my parents left. They left Lexington, North Carolina. They were the first generation to go out into the world and do something different. And my branch of the family was kind of branded as the black sheep a little bit because we did that. So I wore it as a badge of honor and always felt like, well, you grow up in one place, but then you go to other places. Like that's what you do in life. You go to other places. So my father's job moved him around a lot. And then I just saw no reason to stay in one place ever. Contrast that to my sister, who is still in Phoenix, which is the place we did most of our growing up, and she's never left. She's never wanted to leave it. But I have just always wanted to move around, so I've always wanted to try different places, see different ways of life. I feel like I see amongst the United States so much variation across different parts of the country, and I love sort of feeling very connected to different cultures within the one country.
Right, I'm kind of in some ways very similar. My family is all in Vancouver, BC.
Mm-hmm.
And now at one point there were several cousins of mine who were elsewhere in the country or in the continent and in the world. And now I'm the only one who's not in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of hard to be like, you know, there's a bit of a push and pull too, to go back to where you came from, but then it's never really the same.
It's not.
And your life is different and the people who were in your life in the early part of it are different. And
yeah.
I'm coming to grips with a lot of that in the last little while. It's been kind of, you know, one of those moving. Oh, and now,
I mean, to me, I feel like, and I have always said this to students, especially students in architecture school that are thinking about maybe going to grad school, is you can try anywhere else for a year or two or three. Like if you know there's a time limit on, it's going to be a 2-year graduate program, even if you don't like the place, be there for 2 years. It's not a commitment to be there forever. You can always move somewhere else, right? So yeah, go give somewhere else a try, learn what you can. You can always move again.
Yeah.
Although I take a little bit of a melancholy with you saying that, yeah, when you leave a place and then you come back 20 or 30, whatever years later, I'm 55, so I'm starting to get that age, you know, those decades of places that were decades ago in my life. It is different. It is different. It's never the same as it was when you were there before. And I think there's a real danger in thinking that things should stay static.
And that's
kind
of a...
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say that's a really interesting segue into architecture and how things are changing dramatically and what it is that we expect of a built environment.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we provide it as design professionals, whether we're more forward, like... client facing, like an architect or building designer, or sort of in the back end doing the energy analysis and all of those things, is still design work. It's still working with a team, building something, designing, building, constructing, maintaining, all those things.
I mean, I remember, so I started architecture school in 1990 when the Americans with Disabilities Act became, in the United States, became law. And I remember many times with clients talking about accessibility and how, so the law requires, the building code requires you to build a ramp to your building. But your existence, I did a lot of work with churches early in my career, and like your ethos as a church should be about accessibility. It should not just be let's meet the letter of the law. It should be something that goes further than that, that is welcoming and embracing and open to people, you know, with of whatever ability who are coming to your doors. And I feel like in the last, so that was going back into the early 90s, but I feel like in the last 10 years, we've been saying the same about energy to building owners. You don't have to buy the most energy efficient HVAC unit because, you know, it's your building. You can do what you want. You have to meet the code, energy code, but you could also go beyond energy code. Like you could push that further. And as a good steward of the city you live in, of the community you live in, of the air, of the water, of the land, all of that, as a good steward, you can push it further. And so I feel like those conversations are easier these days, right? 10 years ago, that was a hard conversation to have with someone, that you should consider geothermal or you should consider solar panels. And I feel like those conversations are becoming easier.
I think people probably want to
do a little bit more than they have to.
And you absolutely picked out the sexiest technologies that people love, geothermal and solar. It's like, yes, look at my conspicuous conservation.
Yes.
You can't
see
that I don't have any insulation in my walls.
Yeah.
Maybe you can see the crappy two-pane windows, but look at these things. I'm being really facetious and nasty right now.
But no, it's okay.
One of those things that it's so easy to cherry pick those groovy things.
Right.
And then find out, like there's, my partner pointed out the other day, this building, and I was kind of half asleep when he pointed it out to me, but it came across his social media feed, and it was this gorgeous state-of-the-art building with, you know, a living facade, and it had these wind turbines mounted on the top, mm-hmm. over top of these two or three story penthouses.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got all sorts of accolades from LEED and from, you know, all these, you know, won awards, et cetera. They can't run the wind turbines because they make too much noise for the people who paid buck money for their penthouses. So that's an inherent design flaw to the whole process. Like somebody at some point said, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But it got overridden. Is that a word? Mm-hmm. Overridden mm-hmm. by, well, it's sexy, right? Like maybe somebody didn't actually say those words, but you know, somebody was jonesing for the technology and they got it.
Yeah.
And that's trying to talk people out of the sexy technology and actually to the point where, you know, energy conservation is your number one piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can go to the sexy technology, but you can go to a smaller system. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
If you have a smaller system, it means you're not putting as much load on any of the our energy systems
mm-hmm.
and any of the manufacturing systems. So,
I mean, I hear you on the whole idea of it being a sexy sort of proclaiming your virtue to the world through something like a wind turbine or whatever. But I think the sort of flip side of that that I've been thinking about for a while, here in Indianapolis, we have something called the Cultural Trail, which is a bike and pedestrian path that links several different cultural districts in the city. And it was it's been around for, I guess, about 15 years now. And it was much maligned by people when it was first dreamt up. And now it is, of course, much beloved. People absolutely love the Cultural Trail. We're expanding it now. It's beautiful paving. It's nice lighting. It's a nice, good, safe way for people to move about the city, not in a car, right? But then there are rain catchment areas where there are, you know, these within the curb, there's a shallow depression and it's filled with plants and it's a, mm-hmm. it's a rain catchment, right? It's a rain basin to just allow the water to slowly percolate down. And in the winter, they look kind of ugly. Like they look like they're just kind of abandoned little weed pits and people mm-hmm. don't like that. And people want them to look pretty. And I feel like we have to argue, okay, but it is beautiful because what it's doing is beautiful, right?
Yeah.
We have to accept that fact that in the winter, it's not going to be a pretty little garden, but it's going to be doing its job. And then come mm-hmm. spring, it will be a pretty garden again. So I think that there needs to be because I'll say, Shauna, I think a lot of people would say, oh, a wind turbine is not pretty. It's not mm-hmm. beautiful. It's not a sexy statement, but some of us would. And I think it's a sort of, we need to get into an understanding of what is, you know, how to accept things that are beautiful for the ways that they function, even if mm-hmm. they might not be our traditional sort of sense of beauty.
Yeah.
And then tie it all into that. This is it's a complex process we're trying to do. As you say, if someone says the wind turbine's great, it looks cool, it's going to make energy, it's wonderful.
And it's going to be how we're going to sell the product or sell the
But
sell
then
the
it
suite.
Makes people miserable and it makes the building unusable. That's not good design.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. 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 And it becomes a real black eye for the technology too, where it's like, oh, well that didn't work.
Absolutely.
It's like,
absolutely.
Well, yeah. So when you're being an advocate for these new technologies, you have to be an advocate in a very proactive way.
Right.
And say, okay, well, yes, like, and so, like, the work that I'm doing in deep energy retrofits and net zero in new construction, it's like not every site and not every existing house is going to be a good candidate to mm-hmm. get to net mm-hmm. zero.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to give everybody a black eye if you think that you're going to give a silver bullet solution to just offer up net zero as the way that things should be. In terms of new construction, especially because then you're impacting all of the developers who are mm-hmm. like, well, okay, so now I have to drop a third of my lots mm-hmm. to ensure that everybody's got sunlight access. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So there's ebbs and flows. And I think we get into these every once in a while, people get into these places where it's like, this is the silver bullet. This is going to be the solution.
Yeah,
and I was like,
no.
Yeah, no, that's just like, there's never going to be a silver bullet solution.
There is no silver bullet.
For people, there's not going to be that for houses or buildings either.
Yeah, there's no silver bullet. And if something doesn't work at 100% efficiency, if it's working better than it used to, that's still a gain, right? That's still good, even if it's not perfect. So I one of the things I've been doing recently with my job, and I don't know if you're going to ask me about this, was working with nonprofits, doing energy audits of their buildings.
Yes.
And one
of them, I was going to ask.
Yeah. So we have been looking at them and saying, okay, yeah, with a nonprofit institution that owns a little, 1920s firehouse station that was gifted to them by the city, they're not going to be able to afford geothermal. They're not going to be able to, they can't push it as far unless they have a patron, which some places do end up having a patron that says, I'm really interested in solar. I'm donating money to the church to put solar panels on the top. But most nonprofits do not have that fairy godmother. So we talk to them about the sort of little things. Yeah. Light sensor, occupancy sensors in rooms so that when someone walks through a space and then they don't come back to it for 2 hours, the lights don't stay on, just little things like that, which are incremental, but they are all helpful and they help to lead to a frame of mind about sustainability, I think. Insulation is a huge one, which as you say, not sexy at all, but we did one of the recent projects I was in was a church that was built in the 50s and it had blow-in insulation put in the attic in the 80s and that insulation is compressed now. It's bad. And so just blowing in new insulation, no one will ever see it. But it will help. It absolutely will help. And those things are not super sexy, but again, especially if you're on the margins, every bit helps.
Yeah. And I think you can definitely, especially when you're talking about buildings that are used, like not residential buildings, you can definitely use lovely charts that show the total cost of building ownership and said, you're in this for the long haul, right? So 20, 30, 50 years, whatever you are, or church, like forever,
they hope.
So you can actually use that total cost of building ownership to show, here's why you want to make this investment here. And that becomes pretty sexy when you can go to a board and say, well, if we put this much money in now, look at where we stand in 10 years and look at where our mortgage stands or, our loans or whatever, whatever debt they have as an organization, you can actually plot that. And that, I mean, that's what energy service organizations do in general. But I think it's something that's a really key piece to add into how we value these things. Because then once you start to add in your insurance costs the cost of having something in escrow for if you've got oil on site, and that also impacts your insulation costs, your insurance costs. There's a lot when you start adding in all the things, and I'm talking to the converter here, obviously, in terms of operating and all the things that go into keeping a building maintained and running. But you throw those up, and then you say, but if you invest this much money now, you're going to start saving money immediately. Right. Like those kind of charts for people who are in the institutional setting, that sounded weird, in an institutional building.
I know what you mean.
They have a longer picture than somebody who's typically in a house, whereas somebody in a house might have a longer picture, but they always are charging their batteries on this. I got to make a payback in 5 years because I'm going to sell the house, even though you're not going to, for the most part. So total cost of building ownership is much harder to work with in terms of homeowners, unless you throw in how much value, like 5 years down the road with new codes in place, your place, if you've upgraded it to the existing code or better, right? So that's another place where we could actually talk about how does it become sexy? It's because it's giving you way more, street cred and property value and all those things.
Well, one of the things that IFF does particularly with nonprofits is talk to them about assets, about taking on debt and how debt can be good. If it's something like for a house, it's, we don't worry about people having a mortgage. We feel like a mortgage is good debt. Well, nonprofits can do the same. And what that means is also being able to then maintain that building and take care of it as an asset. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. part of the great fun for me as an architect doing energy audits recently is I'm not only looking at the energy use in the building or, you know, things like leaky windows. I'm also just looking at general maintenance. And then I've been able to go back to these nonprofit companies, these nonprofit organizations, and say, you know, your building is in great shape for its age, or your building's in great shape, but in 10 years, this brickwork, this masonry is going to need to be looked at. And it's helping them to just understand their facilities better. And one of our big talking points at IFF is that nonprofits are really good at what they do. Whatever their mission is, you know, saving puppies, housing children, feeding people, whatever it is, they are really good at that mission. They are experts in that mission, and they know what needs to be done. And we shouldn't expect them to also be experts in how to run their building.
Right. Like, yeah, I agree.
We help with that. We tell them when they're at a size that maybe you should have a part-time maintenance staff person, right? Some things like that. Because you do want to maintain your building as an asset, but it shouldn't be something that's detracting from your mission. Your mission needs to be what you're focused on.
Right. So can you actually put the words to IFF? Like, what does that acronym stand for?
IFF initially stood for Illinois Facilities Fund, and it was specifically in Illinois, and it was specifically about getting I'm going to mock up this story, but basically the state of Illinois had put into place new requirements for schools and daycares, and schools and daycares frequently could not afford to meet those requirements, and so the Illinois Facilities Fund was set up as a low-cost loan program to help nonprofit entities meet those requirements, and then it grew into a multi-state across the Midwest CDFI nonprofit organization, and so we shortened it to just IFF. So IFF doesn't really stand for anything right now.
Okay. But it's doing the same work.
Sorry?
It's doing the same work.
The same work, exactly, but across many more markets than just the Illinois school system. So we're in 7 different states, I believe, and I'm in the Indianapolis office. And I like to say we're like a bank, but we're based on vibes. Like, because we can loan money, but we do loan money, but it's not appraisal based in the way that a bank would be. So we can loan more money, and we can base our loans on things that are important, like a really great executive director who's been there for years and is an excellent fundraiser. We can take that into account on the balance sheet. So I say we're like a bank, but it's no appraisals, just vibes.
It's kind of like, is it the one in India is called the Grameen Bank, where you're actually banking on the person?
In a
like
way, that is part of our asset sheet.
Or Kiva is the other one that I know about, where people would actually do very, like, that's microloans, where you would put into a pot for microloans.
Yeah.
So it's not quite the same. But yeah, I think those are really good systems that, you know, are desperately needed, because you have these gaps and holes, and people are falling through safety nets that are crumbling.
Exactly.
And
I mean, I could go off on how there's really no safety net. But I mean, the fact is, if a nonprofit wants to buy a somewhat rundown building in the neighborhood where their services are most needed, a bank will look at that and say it doesn't have any value. It's in a bad neighborhood. It's not in good shape. And we are able to look at the fact that it's actually located exactly where it needs to be, and therefore that can count as an asset. Yeah.
Right. So that helps lift the whole community.
Yes.
By investing that. Yeah. Yeah. I just had a really interesting conversation with a friend of mine who was talking about how do we lift poorer rural communities out of this place, because those are obviously, you know, also, especially here in Nova Scotia and probably in many different jurisdictions, those communities are where the most aid is needed, but those small municipal units don't actually have the firepower to even consider pulling together a proposal for, you know, grant money or anything. That firepower is held by big cities. So
exactly.
A whole raft of stuff goes to big cities. And then within big cities, then you also have those ranges of communities and neighborhoods as well with value. So yeah, so it's interesting how you have these conversations that there's streams and there's parallels in all sorts of different people's heads, all pointing at the same place, which is like, we actually need to do something that's not driven by somebody making a shit ton of money here.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
How's that for a statement?
Right, right. It's good for all of us. It's good for all of us if everyone does well. I mean, that's such an old cliche, but it's so true. And I know we have, as IFF, we are headquartered in cities and tend to work with more nonprofits that are in cities, but we are also very concerned about the rural issue. There is a break in rural neighborhoods being able to get internet access. There's food deserts. Rural mm-hmm. food deserts mm-hmm. are a real thing.
Yeah.
How do we address all of these issues to across the board to people who most need them, and that then benefit their own small community, their own world in which they work. So I think I said in my replies to the initial questions you sent out that despite everything, I remain really optimistic. I am really optimistic about mm-hmm. people being able to come together and make the world a better place. And that really drives everything I do. But it does take work. And to go back to an earlier part of our conversation, it's not always the sexy stuff. It is work. It's hard work. It's dull work. It's putting together all the spreadsheets and everything else and
grinding it out in the back.
Yes.
Not being seen, all those things. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
I would agree with that. I have to be an optimist because otherwise, mm-hmm. Given the fact that I couldn't actually watch An Inconvenient Truth because mm-hmm. years ago, prior to, it was in the 1990s, I read Silent Spring and a couple of other books, and I basically was catatonic for a week. Was, oh my God, it's done. We're done. Yeah. We're doomed. We're done. And then I got up out of bed and had a cup of coffee and went, all right, well, as Margaret Mead said, we're going to go. It's a small group of people and we're going to change the world. So hopefully we keep that going. But it's a hard thing to be pragmatic and optimistic or idealist at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like all these great ideas, all these big ideas. And the fact is you're not failing if you don't make all the great ideas. If you make some dent in that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
You're doing what you should be doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Every little bit, another half inch of insulation. And it does feel frequently like all you're doing is making a little bit of progress. It's definitely two steps forward, one and a half steps back, but it's but it happens.
Yeah. I have days every once in a while it's like, why am I saying the same thing I've been saying for 30 years?
But
we'll get there. If I'm saying it for different people, that's good. If I'm saying it to the same people over and over, that's bad.
So one of the things I'm finding getting older now, like I said, I'm 55, is I do feel like frequently I need to explain to people that maybe this is not the first time this idea has come up, right? Or maybe, mm-hmm. maybe mm-hmm. we have, and I'm thinking of it because I just watched on the internet this, I'm totally diverging here, this found footage of Prince as an 11-year-old. I don't know if you've seen this.
No, I haven't.
Here. Okay, so Prince.
Oh, do tell.
It turns out when he was 11 years old, Prince was interviewed at a teacher strike. This was in 1970, and the teachers were striking, and the local Minneapolis news station found little 11-year-old Prince, and he gave his commentary on why he thought teachers deserved to be paid more. And it's delightful. Go look it up because it is 100% Prince as a little boy, and it is absolutely delightful. But the thing I do find frequently is I will say, in the 1970s, teachers were striking for better pay, better working conditions. Mm-hmm. When I was, 19, I was out there fighting for birth control and abortion mm-hmm. rights. And we are still having to fight those same fights. And like you say, it gets exhausting sometimes feeling like I'm arguing the same thing that we've been arguing for 30 years, 40 years. mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's worth saying. It's still worth saying. It's like I told my husband I love him 25 years ago when we got married. I still love him. It's still worth saying it to him, right? So, we just have to keep saying those things. We have to keep it front of mind for people.
Yeah.
But I do find as an older woman, I feel like I'm now coming to the point where the youngsters are like, well, coming up with these great new ideas for what we're going to do. And I have to say, well, actually, in the 1970s, they proposed some, you know, utopian co-ops like that out in the desert, and they didn't quite work.
Do a little bit more research. It's a great idea. Do some research.
Yes,
find
exactly.
out if somebody tried it and failed, and then learn from what they failed on, right?
Yes. Learn from
absolutely.
That.
I mean, it's the same thing with, you know, I was just on Twitter yesterday. Somebody posted a chart from the IPCC showing different, you know, the cost of doing energy efficiency and carbon capture and all this stuff. And surprise, surprise, reductions in energy, you know, usage and energy load is still the cheapest thing. I'm like, you know, Amory Lovins said that in 1990. And somebody said that before that, because he wasn't the first person who, for whom that light bulb came on for. But, you know, the megawatt has been around as a, you know, that was his choice of term for the value of of energy conservation. So so it was basically it has a value because you're not having to produce
right
a megawatt. You're producing a megawatt. So that concept's been around for a long time, and he's had value. You know, there's been, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Rocky Mountain and Institute and Amory Lovins.
I mean, I've heard of
that work. But I'm also astonished that there are so many people in the industry who don't know about them. but that whole concept, I mean, he actually had a place where it said, when we get to this level of cost for electricity, and I can't remember what that number was, per kilowatt cost, you can actually see that energy conservation is a way better investment than anything else you could do.
Right.
So that was sort of my introduction to this that piece of work that was really well researched. So that's been my whole career. I've been focused on that, and I got about 5 years on you. So
so I mean, I would say maybe I am more well versed as an architect, or more open, and have been more open maybe to the ideas of conservation going way back, because I went to undergraduate school for architecture in Arizona. So in Tucson, Arizona, we were learning to design for the desert. So we were learning a climatic response if not, right. You know, if it was basically required. You can't live in Arizona. I mean, yes, people do live in Arizona in glass skyscrapers, and it's dumb.
It's like, it's dumb to live in glass skyscrapers in cold climates.
It's dumb. But what was taught to me and what was revered when I was in school was building with nature, building with the desert climate that we live in. So there's deep overhangs, there's thick walls to retain heat in the wind. You know, there's all these all these sort of passive environmental ways of building. And so I would say that even in the 80s and early 90s, when this was not maybe as popular in architecture schools, I had already been a little bit inculcated or indoctrinated into that way of thinking about living gently on the earth, because you just kind of have to when you look at the desert and you realize how desert animals and plants and things have adapted. Why, you know, why should humans in the desert not do the same thing, basically? So I think as an architect, I maybe sort of started on first base already when things like Inconvenient Truth came out and people started talking about these ways of living. And I don't know, I'm also the child of a Republican who calls them, and in the United States, the Republicans are very conservative. I don't know if it's the same up in Canada. I know you guys have different.
We got a bunch of those guys too.
But are they called Republicans too, or is it a different term, right?
They're conservatives.
So my father is a conservative. He's deeply conservative, but he rode his bike 14 miles to work in Arizona every day. Because he said, I'm conservative. I don't want to drive
with a small
in beautiful weather when I can ride my bike and get exercise at the same time. And so this notion of what conservative can mean in that way has also been something that has stuck with me.
Like, yeah.
Maybe it wasn't the popular or common way to do it, but it was, in his mind, an extremely conservative thing to do, to ride your bike to work. It just makes sense.
It saves you money. You don't have to deal with the vehicle. Yeah. It saves you time. And the bonus points are it's your gym.
So yeah,
probably when your dad was riding, it wasn't like the gym membership wasn't as key as it
it wasn't become, as big but. A deal. But but yeah, it's like this tackles three big issues all at once. And so why not take advantage of that? That is a conservative way of thinking about it.
Yeah, And I would agree. I would totally agree with that. In my life, that translates into the fact that I have this huge garden.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It provides food for my family. Is it ever going to provide all of my food? Oh, hell no.
No.
But it provides a significant amount of food. I haven't purchased garlic for nearly 2 decades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hardly ever have to buy tomatoes. And now I'm growing enough dry bean that, you know, it's a good portion of our food that I can actually grow.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe it's probably costing me over the years way more than I would have spent on food. However, over the last 20 years that I've lived on this piece of property, I have not had to deal with a gym membership.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with therapy so much because I go out and I just like stick my hands in the dirt and think and just, or not think.
Absolutely.
So, and I'm teaching my kids how to look after
a
piece of land. And so they've been exposed to that. And all of my friends have been exposed to that. And then there's this mutual aid piece that comes into that as well. So I'm able to, with greenhouses and stuff, offer up more seedlings and transplants to people who don't have the space. And then other people can come and I can impart whatever wisdom I have for gardening or experience. And then other people can come and show me stuff. So I'm growing fruit trees now and you know, like, this sounds like it's a little bit of an off topic, but it's really, like, for me, that is conservative. I am a very conservative person, but I am wildly, chaotically anarchist in my politics.
Yes.
Like, no, natural leadership is a thing, and chaos and anarchy are not the same things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to school in Vermont and I took courses in anarcho-feminism and intersectionality and all of these things. I was like, oh, I get all this. But the small C conservative is really important. It's like you look after what you've got and maintain things.
Maintain things. You don't waste things. You save things. You see where this can benefit that. Therefore, that can then benefit this other thing and how those connections can happen. Like, yeah, those connections all come back around. And it is in my mind. I love that you use small C conservative because it also, it's like small C caring. It's caring about things and caring carefully for them. You know, I ask what kind of, do you live in a suburban house? Is it a farmhouse out in the rural? What's your
I live in a two-story walkout that was built in 1986. Basement. And I have about an acre and a half of land. Okay. I'm surrounded by forest. I'm 5 minutes walk away from the ocean. And I can see the ocean over the trees that have grown up over the years. But when I first moved in here, I could see the across St. Margaret's Bay. And I have, my garden is about 60 by 100.
Oh, nice.
And I've got a big greenhouse and I'm putting in another big garden plot this year and another one next year. So I'm basically becoming a wee little farm. I probably won't have
chickens?
Animals.
Do you have any chickens?
Nope. No, my neighbors do.
I had chickens back in my old, I just moved a year and a half ago during the pandemic. We downsized, but I was in a little suburban area and had backyard chickens, which was delightful and wonderful. I loved having chickens. And like you say, I paid more having chickens than I would have paid to buy eggs at the grocery store, but there was so much more to it.
That's not the point when you're doing things for yourself, right?
Yeah.
It's not the point.
Yeah.
What else would I be doing with my time?
Right.
I would be spending money on something that didn't have any value to me or would have less value or would not have less much value to other people. So,
And the delight of the chickens was absolutely priceless. They were delightful. They're hilarious.
They're absolutely hilarious. So I used to actually live on a chicken farm. We had a flock of 120 heritage laying hens And and yeah, that was, it was the best when they were out in the yard, that the little sort of breakfast nook. Looked out on in the mornings and just watching them in their antics. Was, they're hysterical.
They're hilarious. Yeah. So, you know, the touchstones of architecture are utility, firmness, and delight, right? Utility, usefulness, firmness meaning structure, and then delight. And I always think about delight as something that is absolutely a value. It's delight has value, not just economic. It's way more than that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, to me, those chickens were, they were delightful.
I think that's really, that's one of the things that I find that there's so many places where the value, the inherent value of something, whether you could term that the delight of it, or you know, any number of words, but that we have nothing that actually measures that. You know, I mean, I think there's probably systems that do measure it. My neighbor is the executive director of this thing called the Genuine Happiness Index.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I was going to say, aren't there happiness indexes out there? I think there are.
But they're not, you know, there's nothing mainstream.
Mainstream.
Unless you have the, like, you know, I guess delight in purchasing things, you can see which things are getting, they're being sold the most, you know, whether it's some pair of sneakers or whatever, iPhones, whatever. But it's still not the same thing in terms of, like, how do I quantify the joy and delight I have in the garden? It's immeasurable.
I don't know how you could do that.
You know?
So I've seen people do things like, this is just going way afield, but like, I have one of my Twitter friends, and I'm not going to remember who, but maybe it's just as well I don't say his name. He knits, and he's been knitting a scarf that he uses a color depending on how good he felt that day. So if he's having a bad day, he uses a dark color, and if he's having a good day, he uses a brighter color. So he can sort of track a year's worth of mood.
I've seen that.
Or I have another friend, Sean Starowitz, who is an artist, and I will mention him because he's out there in the world being an artist. He did a project where he traded labor with people. This was like an art school project. So he traded labor with people. So like, he needed to borrow a truck to move something heavy. And so he then paid that person back by making them dinner. And he kept track of, you know, X many hours of truck use equals X many hours of sitting together having dinner. And then they weighed it on a scale of like a companionship scale or something, where it was, you know, we got the fun of hanging out together while we did the truck work, and then we also got the fun of eating dinner. So there probably are little ways you could quantify that stuff, but I don't I don't know that any of them goes beyond just a sort of cool art project into something that we would actually bring into our economic value system, basically.
There was a system here called Bay Bucks for a while. I don't know where that went, where you basically traded off labor. But I was heavily involved in being a single parent running two businesses. So I was like, I don't have any free time. I would just be a user. come and help me.
Somebody come help me. And as a single parent, I don't have any money anyway. So
So I want to swerve a little bit. I want to talk about, you know, what got you into architecture, and then talk a little bit about your experience of being a woman in architecture.
Sure. How many hours do you have? No, I'm kidding.
Keep going. Just keep going.
As a kid, I loved making little apartment buildings. I would clear all the books out of the bookcase and make an apartment condo for my Barbie. And once I set up the apartment condo, like, with this is her bed and this is where her kitchen is and all that, I didn't really enjoy the playing part. I really enjoyed the setting up the condo part.
I get that. I hear that.
And then in high school, my friends, a lot of my friends started taking art classes, and they were doing a lot of work about, you know, bad dreams or whatever. And I just felt like painting my emotions on a canvas was too naked. I was too nervous and self-conscious to do that. But then I saw that there were these drawing classes in mechanical drawing. And I was like, well, I love to draw. And that's not, I'm not exposing any of my own personal interior if I draw a gear. So I took the mechanical drafting courses and loved it. And my mother sort of looked at what I was doing and said, Donna, let's think about architecture for you. And yeah, she was right. So when I went down to University of Arizona to visit my sister, who was in college already, and I was still in high school, we stopped by the architecture college. And I walked in there and saw a model of a geodesic dome and said, yep, this is what I want to do.
Me.
And
that, yeah, nice.
That from age 15, 14, 15, it was like, yep, that's what I want to do. And so I never did. And, you know, back in the day, we didn't explore a dozen different Ivy Leagues to figure out where is the best fit. I went to my state school. My state school was there. It was affordable. I went there, and they thankfully now looking back, they had a Bachelor of Architecture program, which, like I said, was quite rooted in desert design, desert based design. We had a really great cohort of students from the Middle East there. So we had a lot of students from Saudi Arabia and from Malaysia, who were also interested in climatic appropriate design. So they had been sent to the U of A basically to specifically study that. And so I did my 5 years in architecture school and wanted to go to grad school because I thought at that point I really wanted to teach, which I've done a little of over the years. But started grad school at the University of Michigan and then ultimately found Cranberg Academy of Art, which is a small art school in outside Detroit. And they offer a master's of architecture, but it's not accredited. And it's a very art focused degree. So it was extremely like go into your studio, design something that you want to design, and then come back out of your studio and share it with the other students and we'll talk about it. So it was extremely opposite of my undergrad, which was very sort of tech focused and you know, so I feel like I had these kind of extremes in the architecture world. And then I have just bounced around a lot. Then I went out of grad school and got a job in Philadelphia because my husband had gotten my then boyfriend now husband had gotten a residency there and went into traditional practice for many years. Got registered. And then a friend of mine said, Donna, come, a friend of mine from undergraduate school, who's still my best friend to this day, asked me to move to Indiana, which is where he's from and where I am now, to come join him as a partner. And so we did residential remodel for about 5 years. And then 2008 hit and the recession, suddenly everything went to hell. and I started working in the facilities department at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. So I went from sort of doing traditional practice to running my own firm, doing very high-end residential design, to then working with the facilities maintenance staff in a large nonprofit institution. And I did that for 5 years. And boy, you want to talk about being a woman in that field? I cannot count the number of times that I would be standing there. Like I said, we need to lay out we were redesigning one of the display galleries. And I said, okay, I want the terrazzo floor to do this, and the baseboard has to land like this. And I would stand there with the craftsman who was building it, and all respect for craftsmen. I respect builders so much, but they do this constantly. I would say it needs to be like this, and the craftsman would look at my boss or my coworker who was male and say, how do you want me to do it? Mm-hmm. I'd say, no, look at me. I'm the one who drew that. I'm the one who designed it. I'm the lady, but I'm the one who says this is how we're doing it. And the craftsman would look at my male coworker and say, is this the right thing? I cannot count the number of times that happened. I was talked over because it was a man standing next to me and the men were talking and they could, you know. Yeah. And that was hard when I was younger. That was a lot harder when I was younger. As I got older, I started just being kind of a jerk about it and saying, hey, no, I'm the one who drew this. I know what it's supposed to be. You need to do it this way. And if you have a question about it, ask me, and I'm more than happy to talk through it. But this feeling of constantly being people not thinking that I know what I'm talking about, that's been a long battle in my career as a woman on the construction site specifically, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that from pretty much every woman who is in the industry. It's like, being talked over, being ignored, having someone say exactly the same thing as you in a meeting after you've said it, and somebody going, oh, man, Mr. That is a brilliant idea. And I'm like,
you
know, all those things. It's very frustrating, but my goal is that we just end up having just more women in decision-making positions. And I hate the term girl boss because no, there's not boy bosses.
There's just
bosses. End of story.
So one of the Twitter accounts I follow is Man Who Has It All. I think it's called Man Who Has It All. And he constantly posts things like, Bob said, I don't mind the term girl boss because girl can mean both men or women. It's like, thanks, Bob, male girl boss. Bob is a male girl boss. Does that? It's just a silly way of thinking about the ways that we use those terms, but it's 100%. It's totally true. And I am struggling. I really work hard lately to say things like craftsperson, not craftsman. Or I'm working on contracts and they say, so many of the AIA contracts even say, when the contractor finds a conflict, he will bring it to the attention of the owner. And I'm going through and striking those out and changing it to, they will bring it to the attention of the owner.
Language
again, it's matters. These tiny little incremental bits. It's a little half inch of insulation.
You use your words. They matter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. They will do this, not he.
Yeah.
Just because most contracts. But I will say, like, I worked one of the best projects I worked on here in Indy when I was doing residential work. It was actually one of the few ground up new build houses that we did. And it was a female general contractor. And she is fantastic, continues to be. She's been a real groundbreaker in the city in terms of prefabricated construction. Ursula David is her name. And she basically said she worked for a general contractor for a couple years. And she said, I could do this. I'm smart enough to do this. And so she went out on her own and started a business. And, she also dealt, of course, with a lot of that cement contractor saying, really, you're the boss here? But for women of our age, we had harder battles back, 30 years ago when I started architecture school, it was 20% women. And nowadays it's more than 50% women. So we've broken through a lot of ground, but we have not gotten there yet.
Yeah. I think we've broken through a lot of ground in very specific silos of the industry.
Certainly.
Right. Because we're still less, depends on who you talk to, 4 to 10% representation of women actually in the field on the tools.
Right.
And that's still not a pretty place to be. In terms of your experience, the attrition rate is like three years in, and women are just biffing out of their careers that they may have really enjoyed, but the work environment is shit.
Which again, my optimism is that, especially with the pandemic, my hope is the silver lining of the pandemic might be that we come out of it saying flexibility in the workplace is important and everyone wants it, which means we're not just giving breaks to moms who have to go pick up their kids at daycare when they have to leave right at 5 o'clock.
Parental,
but it's for everyone.
Parental,
like, that's for everyone. It's not just a women's issue.
Yeah.
It's a good human workplace issue.
Yeah.
So my hope is that will be an attitude. And I think it is. I think more and more people, men and women and others, are saying, a good work-life balance is essential, and I'm not going to, I can't let my work ruin my family life, no matter what, whether that's taking care of your elderly parent, which is something I had to struggle with, or taking care of your young children, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So I feel like what I used to always say is workplace policies that are good for women are good for humans.
Yeah.
And that is why everyone should embrace them.
Yeah. I have a big sort of rant that I continue on whenever anybody talks about, it doesn't really matter. Women don't really want to be in the industry because it's so hard. It's like, well, let me talk about how hard it is on men to be in this industry, right?
Yes.
Most of the guys who are, in the field, their bodies are shot to crap
Yes.
Before
absolutely.
They're 40, right? They got
absolutely.
Bad shoulders, they got bad knees, they got bad hips, they got a bad back. They, you know, maybe they got a concussion that takes yeah. them out for a while. You know, like that's not good either.
It's not. So, it's you not. Know,
so that's, you know, and being away for months on end or weeks on end or starting mm-hmm. at 6 and ending at 6 and not seeing your kids.
Yeah.
Like that's not good either. Like
that's
you know,
not good for anyone.
Yeah. yeah.
and I feel
yeah.
like we're coming finally as a culture, maybe a little bit more around to that attitude. So. The other thing I'll point out, because I do think there are some movements in the construction world to bring women in. There's some apprenticeship program in Philadelphia that's about women electricians, getting women elected to become electricians. Here in India, we're working with a group called the Latinas Welders Guild, which is a women, Latina women learning welding. And my husband has been trying to hire one of their welders. like, you know, I think that again, there are moves to try to break through that wall and make it so that mm-hmm. a woman on the job site is as accepted and understood as a man on the job site. But again, I want it with the caveat that you just pointed out, the current construction industry eats people up and spits them out. And we need to yeah. not treat people that way. They're workers. Yeah. They're good. They're doing labor. They need to be treated well for their labor.
Yeah.
So.
We are almost out of
yeah.
time.
Yeah. It's gone quick. It's been so fun yes. chatting with you.
yeah. I think that we could probably have a few more of these because we haven't touched on People for Urban Progress.
Yeah.
And I think there's a bunch of stuff that we could talk about more. But
there's a bunch with my nonprofit. Yeah. It's People for Urban Progress were a nonprofit that got started when the RCA Dome and Indianapolis, the Hoosier Dome was being taken down and it had an air fabric supported roof. And the founder of the nonprofit, Michael Bricker, went to the city and said, so that building's being demolished. What's happening to all that fabric, that Teflon coated fabric? And it was destined to be landfilled. And Michael saved 13 acres of fabric. 13 acres and found a place to store it and then started doing cool stuff with it, like making bags, making shade structures. And we've grown in from there to a bigger reuse nonprofit. So yeah,
they're cool.
Again, well, I could talk about that for easily an hour. So we'll do that some other time.
We'll do that another time, but we'll make sure that we have, if you just send me the website
sure.
for that organization, we'll definitely put that in the show notes because that's awesome.
Yeah.
You're booked for the fall season.
Okay, great.
We'll talk about People for Urban Progress.
That's yes, fantastic. I would love to come back and talk about them.
Cool. And I also have a couple of questions to ask you about nerdy things, but I'll ask those next time too. Because
okay, great.
Wrapping
yes.
up. So thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. It's been great to actually have a real chat with you as opposed to a Twitter back and forth.
Yeah. No, it's been super, super fun. I really look forward to coming back and put some pictures of your garden up. I want to see.
okay. Okay. I will.
I want to see this conservative wonderland that you're building in your backyard. Anarchist conservative.
yeah, the anarcho-conservative. Yeah. Anarcho-eco-feminist. That's me. Yeah.
There you go. Yes. All those things. All those
all
things.
All right. So that's it for our episode today. And thanks for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in. This episode was produced by Blue House Energy, Podcast Atlantic, and Tanya Media. Subscribe and don't miss an episode. Leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time.